I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today on the show, we'll tell you the first steps in designing a downtown that boosts the economy and helps people get around without their cars. We'll speak with urban designers George Crandall and Don Arambula about 21st century retail, reconcentrating a city's downtown, and why parking is still important even when you want people to drive less. And we'll check in with Danique Nobles. Danique is an alumnus from Teach for America who now serves as the organization's recruitment director. She'll tell us about completing the program and how she's now working to bring other bright young college graduates into the teaching profession. All that plus Nate Berg with Planetizen and our City Views commentator Walker Smith coming up after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. My first guests have been responsible for a number of award-winning revitalization projects around the country. From designing the smart growth of Racine, Wisconsin's downtown, to redesigning the Central Library in their hometown of Portland, Oregon, George Crandall and Don Arambula are looking to revitalize America's cities. You just completed a downtown plan for Missoula, Montana. When you tackle a plan for a city like Missoula, what is the first assessment you make?
The idea is really to strengthen the downtown economy. So we look at the land uses in the downtown, and typically you find that the retail has been eroded over time. The retail is the toughest thing to get right in the downtown, so we look for ways to strengthen the retail offering in the downtown and increase that offering over time.
Why is the retail the toughest thing to get right?
Because it's very site-sensitive. You just can't put it anywhere. You need lots of drive-by traffic, the parking that's required then to serve that retail, and it has to be in a high-visibility location. Too often, we find that retail is in the wrong place. It's hard to find, and it's isolated, and therefore it's weak. So the whole idea is to create a framework that will lead to a very strong retail development in the downtown.
One thing you need to know is that retail is a very precious commodity in most communities across the country are what is described as over-retailed. For example, the National Trust of Historic Preservation did a survey a number of years ago, and they found it's over 30 square feet per person in the country, and what's supportable is about 18 or 19. So we have so much retail, whether it's big box shopping centers or downtown retail. So building retail in the downtown is a vital component to attracting mixed-use housing projects, keeping jobs in the downtown. So when you've already got that big supply, trying to get into the downtown simply because it's over-retailed becomes a very difficult issue for downtowns.
Don, you raise a really terrible conundrum, the 30 square feet per person. We only need 18 square feet per person of retail. And of course, now we're in a terrible down cycle. And I think everyone agrees we're overstored now and you're seeing retailers close. Given that environment, for parts of the community like downtowns, like perhaps older neighborhoods that need retail for their vibrancy, for their vitality, how do you get it? How do you create that framework that you talked about that will strengthen retail?
Well, it comes down to design and understanding, one, what are the fundamental requirements for a retailer? You need to realize that you got to build for 21st century retail, not 19th century, which means clear span open spaces for buildings. So first of all is understanding what the building needs to be and identifying sites that can support it. And so that's the first part, is understanding the design issue, not just from a policy standpoint saying we want downtown retail, but understanding what the retailers need to survive. For example, one of the most essential components of downtown retail in any retail is to have on-street parking. And it's not even a question of having a lot of parking, but a little bit of parking out in front of a shop can mean success or failure for a business. If you're like me, often you'll go downtown and you'll look for that on-street parking space, and you may miss it, and you might hope you get it every time, but then you'll circle around the building and go to a parking structure. So there's a lot of subtlety of understanding how retail works and to make it successful is starting with design.
George, how do you do retail that works, 21st century retail, and yet still preserve the wonderful qualities that more concentrated neighborhoods like downtowns have?
Parking is essential. Don talked on it, but you can only park about 20% of the parking you need for retail on the street. And many communities really don't realize this, and that's why the retail is weak, and that's why it's scattered. And so what has to be done is parking structures need to be provided, and they can't be provided just anywhere. They need to be within a block of that retail, and it's most desirable if the sight lines between that parking and the retail street are very clear. Many communities are not willing to or do not understand that if they want to compete with the malls and the retail on the edge, that they need to have grandma-friendly parking. And that means that not only the on-street, but you need so much parking for every square foot of retail. And as I said, only 20% of that can be provided on the street within a block. And quite often communities say, well, we've got parking on the street, but it's a lot of it 3 or 4 blocks away or 5 blocks, and people just aren't going to walk that distance. So that's one of the fundamentals, to find out where that parking structure should be, indicate how that might be built, and in a configuration that is shopper-friendly. And there are different kinds of parking structures. A commercial parking structure, you and I will park in just about it, probably anything, if we're going to work. But if you're a shopper, it needs to be shopper-friendly, and that means light, airy, very clear circulation. And so it's a very different requirement altogether. So we hate to really focus on the auto here, but it's a very important part of having successful retail in the downtown.
Don, when you begin a plan for an existing area, like a downtown area or perhaps an older neighborhood, do you start with its strengths and build from there, or do you start with weaknesses?
Well, you need to do both of those. What we say is you build up your strengths, and then you find ways to mitigate or overcome the weaknesses. But the key piece of this is not to be so concerned about churning information about existing conditions, but really going quickly into an alternative process that starts looking at ways of solving those sorts of problems. So, for example, if you've got a downtown retail core that has some successful, let's say, local businesses, those are very important to strengthen. And often the best way of strengthening those local businesses is that with an infusion of a couple of anchor uses that might not be local, but they might be a national chain. But the key is getting a good balance of those uses so that it doesn't become sterile and it looks like any place in the USA, but then they strengthen your local businesses, because we know that if you have a lot of local businesses, the dollars spent locally recirculate into the community much more often than they do if it's a national chain where the dollars are exported off to someplace like Arkansas, for example.
A really exotic place.
Yes, exactly.
Tell me this. You work all over the country. Are weaknesses typically easy to categorize? Are weaknesses generic?
We see the same weaknesses everywhere. It's really no mystery. And quite often communities spend too much time visioning and trying to identify what it is they want. And basically, we can go through a protracted exercise or a long and drawn-out exercise, and the results are always the same. Everyone wants clean air and clean water and safe streets and good schools. And so the needs are the same everywhere. The solutions, though, are always different because the topography of a community is different. The economics are different.
I am so glad to hear you say that. You have a saying. You say that community vision is important, but it's overrated. And I guess that's what you've described to me just now as why you think it's overrated.
Yeah, it's way overrated.
Way overrated.
Way, way overrated. We find communities, and we have to poke at our own community here in Portland, where they spent, the number is $1.5 to $2 million developing a vision. And basically, it's the kind of thing that we basically, when we go into a city, develop in an evening.
Is there an advantage, though, George, to the community feeling as if it has participated? Or instead, is there some sort of letdown feeling like, gee, is that all there is? Is that our vision? What do you find?
Participation, it really comes through the development of alternatives in response to the community's goals and objectives, or we can say vision, I guess that's an interchangeable term. That's where the community truly participates, because they then have a say in how they want to respond to their vision.
So you sort of say, get on with the vision and let's get to the solutions.
Absolutely.
That's interesting. What do you think are the thorniest issues today in urban planning and design?
We think the big one today is this loose term called sustainability. And what does that mean? And we think that people are generally misguided in their response to the term. They talk about green roofs and pervious streets and other things, and all of that's fine. But the big issue is, how do you reduce our dependence on the auto? Because that has profound economic consequences for this country. And so we believe that that is the new frontier. We believe that what we're calling balance-centered development is something that the whole country needs to look at. And for example, if we take a one-mile radius and we look at that population within that one-mile radius, and we say, let's locate in the center all the things that people need that generate auto trips. So you have the shopping trip, the work trip, the recreation trip, and you locate those facilities in the center so that people can either walk or bike or have a shorter auto trip. We believe, when we've run the calculations on this and have worked in enough communities, to know that we can reduce auto trips in a community by at least the length of the auto trips by at least 30%. So we also look at alternative modes of transportation, and of course that's transit. It also means walking. It also means using the bicycle. And we know that if we have on-street bike lanes, the maximum number of people you'll get riding bikes may be about 10% of the trips, or those potential auto trips, because of safety issues. We know that if you have protected bike lanes, in other words, you get them off the roadway or alongside the roadway, separated from auto traffic, you can get about 40% of your trips on bicycles. And of course, we have European examples of that in Denmark and in the Netherlands. We think that by changing how we look at land use and concentrating development in centers and providing for this, the alternative modes, walking and bikes being a big one, that we can reduce auto energy consumption by over 50%. And that has profound impacts for the U.S. economy.
All right, help me out here. Theoretically, makes plenty of sense, but most couples both are working, if they're lucky enough. They both want to be working these days. And it is highly unlikely that they're both going to work 1 mile from home. So how do you resolve this thing where I'm working in downtown and your ward, the spouse is working in the suburb? I mean, we're so spread out over the landscape today. How do you reconcentrate these things?
The average trip length, for example, in the U.S. is about 10 miles. And we're saying reduce that by 30%. And so you get it down to about 6.5 miles. That means that some of those trips are obviously out of the center. So it counts for your couple with one working in the center and one working outside the center. So we're not saying there's an absolute here at all. We're saying we can play with what appears to be reasonable. And we think it's very reasonable to infill in the center of the city, because we've done this in any number of communities, to create jobs and recreational opportunities, those being the big trip generators, in the center, and that will have a profound impact. We also know that there's all sorts of potential for creating these protected bikeways, simply because we, in most cases, have more road capacity than we need in a city. In other words, more room, and that those can be created as well. So it isn't far-fetched. It isn't a utopian dream. It is something we think that is well within reach. There just needs to be some agreement that this is a good thing to do. And we were talking on our way over here today about your town, Memphis. And Don and I were in Memphis looking at your potential light rail. And we were talking to one of your politicians, and he said, you need to understand, in Memphis, sprawl is not necessarily a bad word. And in fact, it is a bad word because it has led us to where we are today with this dependency on foreign oil.
Well, that's a discouraging revelation, but I'm not going to argue that it was said. Let me come back and just clarify one point you're making about the protected bike lanes. Describe what you mean by protected bike lanes.
The first thing you have to understand is why they're protected. Well, because the first reason why most people will not ride bicycles is because of safety. They don't feel comfortable mixing it in, even in a bike lane next to a couple-ton vehicle. So what it is a six-foot-wide bike path that is separated physically. Typically on a roadway, for example, if you have on-street parking, it's next to the sidewalk rather than next to the travel lane. And so that's the primary difference of it between a bike lane and a protected bike lane. There is a physical separation either through a curb and landscaping or separation with a parked car as the difference.
And in the European examples we cited, certainly in the Netherlands, they have about a 40% mode split or even better. And it's because of the protected bike lanes. People feel safe.
For example, here in Portland, we'd probably be described as probably the bike-friendliest community in the United States. Well, our modal split is about 8 or 9%, and it's kind of topping out. We've got a great system of bike lanes. And what the next generation for this city is really looking at these Amsterdam and Copenhagen examples and saying, can we increase that ridership? And the only way you can make the next step up is by going to a protected system. And there's hard evidence through these Scandinavian countries that that's the difference that it takes to transform these. Because these cities didn't have these in perpetuity. It's essentially since the 60s and 70s when they started seriously looking at bicycles as a transportation mode that they changed their urban form as auto-congested and auto-choked as the United States, especially Copenhagen.
There's a lot of conversation about transit-oriented development. I know your firm has done a lot of work in this area. Tell me the criteria for TODs. How do I know it when I see it?
Well, the TOD difference would be is when you've got density and you've got housing choices that support transit within a walkable distance of a transit station. So those are the things that we're looking for. It's usually based on a tight grid of walkable streets, and those are the things that we look for when we do TODs.
But also, the other thing is to get the right mix of development then within that center, same kind of thing. You want the retail and commercial services then to serve that community. Too often, the push is to create a transit station and then have suburban development around it. So the planning needs to be done. The frameworks need to be developed. The pluses and the minus clearly understood. And in the end, it's in the community's interest to have these transit-oriented developments around the stations. And it's in the interest of supporting transit because more people then use transit and you have fewer people on the roads.
And who needs to lead the planning? Because I know that's a problem in some cities where the transit authority is simply worried about transit, and then the city or private developers have to do the rest, and so the parts never quite come together.
Typically, we'd like to see planning bodies lead this development process and work intimately with the transit agencies. And it's one of the real big mistakes is that it's an afterthought. Communities build transit lines, and then they say, let's build TODs. And often what we find is when we go back and look at these at the transit stations, if they would have only been moved, for example, 200-300 feet, it makes all the world of difference between you can get trans-supportive development as opposed to whether you can or cannot. So it's the earlier that you can get the planning teams involved in doing TOD work, the better off and the more chances that you're going to be successful. But metropolitan planning organizations, local agencies need to be leading this and partnering with transit agencies.
Don, what are the biggest mistakes cities are still making in land use and urban design?
Looking at things from a policy level from 10,000 feet and not really understanding that they need to get down on the ground and do a site-specific design, test it and not do a generic one-size-fits-all sort of approach.
And just following up on that, we work in any number of places, and Don alluded to this a little earlier, where they build a transit station and they say they will come. And the answer always is they don't come, or often the land is committed to the wrong thing. For instance, we are up in Edmonton, Alberta right now, and where they built a system, and it's a great system, and we're looking at one of their stations where they really haven't had any development in many years. And so in the end, it takes a framework plan, a development plan, to encourage the right kind of investment around these stations. Investors want certainty. They want to be confident that if they are to invest in these station areas, that they know what the neighborhood is going to be like. And so in the absence of a strong plan, a framework plan, supported by the public and the public agencies, we do not see the development occurring around these stations in the way that it should.
So, for example, this is what communities typically do. They'll go from a broad policy standpoint and talk about goals and objectives and a vision. And then they go directly then to trying to adjust their codes. They try to establish design standards. What they're really missing is a secondary piece of that, and a kind of a linkage and a bridge between all of that is really doing the physical framework plans that Georgian meant to really will inform them of what they need to do to translate those visions that we talked about into the codes that will then implement them.
It's all about design in the end. And so these framework plans have to be based on a design. Design alternatives need to be prepared because there's always more than one way to do it, and it's usually pretty obvious there is a best way to do it. But these design plans are very detailed because they not only say what your circulation framework will be, but how big the blocks are and what should go on those blocks and what blocks are critical to the overall scheme, how much public investment is required, and also then how much private investment would be stimulated.
We are almost out of time, but I have two more quick questions for you. One, we talked earlier with David Goldberg from Transportation for America about both the economic stimulus package as well as the transportation reauthorization bill, which will come up later this year. If you were using both the stimulus package as well as the transportation reauthorization bill to accelerate what you would consider to be smart planning, what would you be looking for in the package and in the bill?
I would be looking for funds to design those balance center developments because it means that the transit is going to be located in the right place, serving the right kind of density. And so in the absence of doing those framework plans for these balance center developments that will reduce vehicle miles traveled, we'll never see the full benefit of transit.
And to what do you attribute Portland's enormous appeal to young adults?
I think the ability is to live in a community where transit's available, where it's walkable. There's a sense of community because there's parks and open space. There's a vital downtown. There's a connection to the natural environment because we've got an urban growth boundary. You can easily access the rivers, the coast, the mountains. All those things, I think, are pretty universal values for any community around the country. I think Portland has had the history over the last 40 years of valuing those and building off of those from a policy standpoint, and then gone through the processes that we've talked about as far as developing framework plans and then the following up of the ordinances that support that. So it's something that has been building for generations, and I think the people who are benefiting from it right now are those people who are moving here.
I want to thank you both for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Thank you.
George Crandall and Don Arambula are the principals of Crandall Arambula, an urban design firm in Portland, Oregon. Their interview was engineered by Blue Dog Recording. Now for the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
The shopping mall is dead. Well, at least one shopping mall is, anyway. The Columbus City Center in Columbus, Ohio, has been slated for demolition. And while this is one isolated example, it's representative of the state of traditional enclosed shopping malls all over the country. The Columbus Dispatch reports that the nearly abandoned mall will be torn down during the summer in order to make room for an urban park and mixed-use project the city hopes will add a new spark of interest to the city's struggling retail sector. Plans begin with the park, and officials are hoping to get some federal stimulus money to get the project started. But with a $165 million price tag, it may be 5 or even 10 years before this mall flowers into the urban shopping experience of the future. And while the mall on that site is on its dying legs, Paris's highly touted citywide bike-sharing program is experiencing its own troubles. Theft and vandalism have plagued the system since its opening a year and a half ago. The BBC is reporting that more than half of the original 15,000 bikes have disappeared since the summer of 2007. Practically all of the original bikes have been replaced since then, and the costs are mounting up to what may soon become an unpayable price. J.C. DeCal, the outdoor advertising company that runs the bike system, is reportedly seeking a revision to the contract it signed with the city, arguing that rising costs are making operation impossible under the current agreement. The system has remained popular among Parisians, but unless the business model is reworked, J.C. DeCal warns the days of bike sharing in Paris may be coming to an end. And as bad times loom in Paris, an ambitious and hopeful mayor in the U.S. is hoping to score on a huge gamble to resurrect his city's decaying downtown. Las Vegas Mayor Oscar B. Goodman is pushing a broad redevelopment plan that looks to revive the Sin City's formerly bustling and now defunct downtown area. According to an article from the New York Times, Goodman wants to rebuild City Hall and also add new housing, retail, and office space to the area. His plans also include bringing in a new casino resort, the first in the area in more than 30 years. The overall price tag for this facelift could reach more than $250 million, most of which could fall on taxpayers. And though Goodman predicts that the project could create more than 13,000 jobs, opponents argue that this type of mega project just won't make any sense until the economy gets into better shape. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, we'll get back in touch with Danique Nobles of Teach for America and find out more about the front lines of closing the achievement gap. I'm Carol Coletta.
Hi, I'm Scotty Iseri, and if you're hearing my voice right now, it means you're listening to the podcast version of Smart City. And I have a message specifically for you, the podcast listener. We usually get a lot of really great comments via email from our listeners. They have questions about the show, things they heard. They have comments about things we got wrong or things we got right. Really intelligent input, and we thought, why don't we create a space online where our listeners can talk to each other? That's why we've created My City. My City is a social networking site for urban enthusiasts, people that love cities, people that want to see cities thrive, people that have ideas about making the next great city. So, how do you join? You send me an email. My personal email, I'm giving this out, Scotty, S-C-O-T-T-Y, at smartcityradio.com. Send me an email, I'll send you an invite, join the conversation online. One more time, it's Scotty at smartcityradio.com. Thanks for listening.
I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Teach for America is a national corps of outstanding college graduates who commit to teaching in our nation's public schools for 2 years after graduation. In 2006, we spoke to first-year teacher Danique Nobles about the trials and tribulations of teaching a special education class in the public education system. In terms of the challenge, describe what it is about the situation that is so challenging to you.
For me, one key thing is organization. Being a teacher and working in Memphis City Schools, there is a ton of paperwork, whether it's Memphis City School paperwork, whether it's grading papers, whatever the case may be. And I'm not the most organized person in the world. So that was a really, really big thing that I struggled with. And I actually still am struggling with that. Also, being that I do teach special ed, having children on all different levels and having to plan for my children and pulling things for my children and being sure that I am able to meet all of their needs, that's a challenge as well.
Yeah, special ed teachers have lots of extra paperwork.
Yes, ma'am, we do.
I know. My sister is one and has been for many years. Danique, how have your students surprised you, if at all?
Let me think. They're always surprises, actually. I mean, I can't recall a day when I'm like, not like, oh my God, you know. They have surprised me in the sense that, not like I already knew that they were able to learn and willing to learn, and they're actually very self-motivated. That wasn't surprising to me because I feel like my expectations was for them to be that way. Honestly, I don't think I've had very many surprises that I didn't already anticipate, I should say.
Do you sense that your students are making progress where it's measured today? And that's in terms of performance on test.
I definitely feel that way. And to say the least, I have one particular student who, when I entered the classroom, my second or third week of teaching, and, you know, I gave him his diagnostics, he registered reading at a second grade level. And now he's on a fifth grade level, and he's actually in the sixth grade. So for me to actually see this and see that, it's not really a milestone for me. It's like a major, you know, accomplishment that we made together. Of course, I think that they are, you know, learning, and it's showing. It's showing.
Well, some time has passed, and now Danique is back with us. She's finished her tenure as a teacher and now works for Teach for America as its recruitment director for the Southeastern region. Danique, you taught for how long?
I taught for 2 years.
2 years. And you were teaching where?
I taught in Memphis, Tennessee at a school called Frazier Elementary.
Frazier Elementary, I know it well. Describe the school you taught in and its student population.
It was about 97% African American students. I would say it was a fabulous school, wonderful leadership and support structures there. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
In your 2 years of teaching, were you able to make what you felt personally was progress?
I was. And I was actually, I received a phone call from my principal talking about the progress that my students made in their classrooms and how proud of me she was over the summer after I finished my 2 years. So I was definitely able to see progress. During my second year, my students had a goal of gaining a year's growth in reading and in math. And they all accomplished their goal, and some of them exceeded their goal. So I was able to definitely see growth in my students, both academically and personally.
So in part, it was about value add. So wherever the students are, when you get them, your job as a teacher is then to add value.
Right.
Let me ask you, you now recruit teachers for Teach for America, which, of course, has been a very popular program that just really has taken off nationally. What do you look for in potential candidates for Teach for America?
So there are actually several things that makes a person a strong candidate. Past achievement, whether that's in activities on campus or whether you work a job to maintain status in school. And perseverance, but also a part of that is critical thinking skills, some sort of organizational ability, a respect for families in low-income communities. I would definitely say a passion for the mission of Teach for America and really want to see your student succeed, and writing ability.
Why has Teach for America become so popular on college campuses with top students on college campuses? Why do they want to enter teaching?
I could say I never saw myself as a teacher, but to know that it was an organization that was driven by this passion to close the achievement gap, and understanding that I grew up in a low-income area and I was the first college grad in my family, for me to see like-minded people that are just as driven as I was, it was very important. That's what drew me to Teach for America. So I think it just kind of depends on the person, but that was my reasoning.
I have to ask you more about your comment. I find it fascinating. I never saw myself as a teacher. I saw myself as a member of this high-performing organization called Teach for America. What is the difference?
Well, for me, when I say I never saw myself as a teacher, I was thinking like in my lifetime, like I never thought that I would enter a classroom. When I came to college, I never thought that I would enter a classroom. So once I entered Teach for America, I saw myself as a teacher, but I also saw myself as a member of this organization that were on the same page as I was. Like, we didn't think of this as necessarily a job. It was a passion. And everybody that I came in contact with in Teach for America felt the exact same way.
If you were like Michelle Rhea's doing, former Teach for America teacher, now running a school system, what would you do to imbue your school system with that same passion so that people could sort of skip the Teach for America route and go directly into teaching for an urban school system?
That's a really great question. For me, what drove me was to see students that some people may have thought that they could never do it, and to see them do it was just fire beneath me. And so I think for other people to see my passion about it got them more excited about it. So I think just to kind of have people around that can excite other people or that could push other people, I think that's very, very important. I think that that's what makes Teach for America so successful, is that we are all kind of in this mindset and we kind of go out and produce.
Do you feel that support system that Teach for America provides of these passionate people all around the country who believe they're in this for the cause, do you need that to support you in addition to what you see in the school system in which you're teaching, where that passion may not be consistently shared across all teachers, all schools?
It was helpful, but not necessarily needed. I kind of came into it with this mindset of, this is where I came from, and this is important to me because this could have been me. Like, if I didn't have a teacher or a couple of teachers that pushed me, and my mom and my dad that pushed me, I could have very well not been a college graduate. And so it was very helpful to have that group of people that surrounded me and that pushed me and that encouraged me throughout my 2 years. But it was also a personal determination for myself.
When you look to recruit teachers for Teach for America, you said that you look for people who have an appreciation for poor children and the circumstances they come from. As you say, you could identify with these students very easily. You say it could have been you. Do you think that helped you in a way that, let's say, people who maybe have the care but have never lived that life, do you think it helps to have lived that life and imagine yourself and being able to imagine yourself as that student?
I would definitely say that it helped me. But on the flip side of that, I would also say that I've had numerous colleagues that didn't come from my background that were just as successful, and their kids loved them the same. So I would say that it helped me initially to kind of hook my students, I guess you can say, because they could see themselves in me. But at the same time, in the end, any person that loves their children and that are determined and that have high expectations will definitely succeed.
Now, I have to ask you this. It's a little bit of an uncomfortable question, but you taught for 2 years.
Right.
2 years. And now you're out of the classroom doing good work. But nonetheless, we clearly don't need teachers who are in for 2 years and then out. Wouldn't you agree?
I agree.
So is Teach for America, I know that a certain percent of the teachers go into teaching or go into administration, and I know they all come out as promoters of, I've heard the sales pitch. They all come out as supporters of public schools and so forth, and that's all a good thing. But is this a sustainable model for sort of new ways to inject teaching with high-performing people?
First of all, Teach for America, true enough, is a 2-year commitment. But once you finish your 2 years, there are 67% of our alumni that remain in education. So some people come in thinking that I'm not going to stay and this is just for 2 years, but like fall in love with it and decide to stay. Also, our alumni that whatever they decide to go do understand that the achievement gap is multifaceted. We need people in every sector. So, for example, if you want to go on and be a doctor, that's totally fine. And we have numerous doctors that go on and pursue their MD because this is their dream, but still aid in giving back because, okay, if you're a child in a low-income community and you can't receive quality health care, well, our doctors are those doctors that give quality health care, because understanding if you're sick, you don't want to go to school, you're not learning. So maybe not in the classroom, but they're still aiding to close the achievement gap in whatever way they see fit.
And that makes sense, except that we still need good teachers in classrooms.
Right.
So how do we get enough of them? If you were, again, let's say remove yourself from Teach for America. You've taught, you've recruited. What would you do to get teachers into people, good students, good college students, or let's say people who've had successful careers who may want to, for whatever reason, think about teaching now? How would you, you know, how would you think about engaging them in teaching?
Being a recruitment director, I talk with thousands of students on different campuses, and several students have told me that their number one reason for not wanting to go into the education field is money. It's important that, in my opinion, teachers should probably be paid more than anyone else, because if it wasn't for teachers, we wouldn't have anyone else. And so I think that that's important. And I know that Michelle Rhee is trying to tackle that issue in Washington, D.C. And so I think that, one, okay, if you pay teachers more, they may want to come. But two, on the flip side of that, hold them accountable. So you can't come in and make X amount of money and not produce results in the end. So I think that it's kind of a two-way street.
What remains the biggest challenge in the classroom for teachers?
I really don't know. I really don't know. And I would say for me, my greatest challenge was kind of internal, would be those days that I didn't feel like my students grasped the lesson how they should have, or I didn't feel like I did such a good job relaying how to teach X, Y, and Z. I think that those were probably my greatest challenges in the classroom, but I'm not sure for all teachers.
Do you think teachers get the support that they need from their principals? Is that generally true or generally not true?
In my experience in Memphis, I would say that's generally true. There was not a time when I felt like I was not supported. My principal had this open door policy, and if I needed anything, and actually only on a few occasions would I go to her. I had so many support structures in place that I really didn't have to go to my principal.
When you say support structures, besides Teach for America, what do you mean?
Right, and I had a new teacher mentor at my school who was phenomenal. She had been teaching for probably about 19 years. I had teen teachers on my special education team. I had a special ed regional director. I had numerous people that weren't in special education that had taught my children before, and I could go to them for anything, but lots of people.
If you could eliminate any rule or regulation or policy made at the, let's say at the school system level, that you think gets in the way of you and your colleagues doing their jobs in the classroom, what would you eliminate?
I'm not going to say that I would eliminate standardized testing, because I think that there needs to be a way for children to be assessed at the end, but I would try to tweak that in a sense, because I really don't think for all children a paper and pencil standardized test is the best way to test their knowledge. So I think that that's a really big issue with teachers and this high level of anxiety, because they know that if their results don't come back how they think they should come back, then there's a problem. And I think that that gets in the way of a lot of great teachers being great in the classroom.
What would you do instead?
I don't think there's a cut and dry solution, because all students learn differently. I mean, we have students with special needs. We have students who learn differently. That's something that really needs to be thought about. I mean, coming up with not this blanket statement for everyone, but to take into consideration all children.
What's the market like out there today on college campuses? I would think that a lot of people would think teaching might sound pretty darn good right now.
It just kind of depends on where you are. I mean, I've heard of numerous things about graduate school and law school, and of course I know like law schools are more competitive and med schools are more competitive. It just kind of depends on where your heart is. Some people look to teaching as like a, well, if I don't get in law school, then I'll go teach. But it just kind of depends.
So you're seeing a lot of students maybe thinking, given the economy, now's a good time to go ahead and get additional education.
If possible.
Yeah, if they can afford it.
Right.
Yeah. What campuses are you recruiting on?
My two main campuses are Florida State University and University of Alabama, but I also work with Mississippi State University, University of Mississippi, and University of Mississippi for Women.
So you have Southern, big Southern campuses.
Right.
How long has it been since you've been in college?
I graduated in 2006.
2006, so not so long ago. Anything, do you notice any big changes in the students on campus today versus when you were in school?
Not really. I think that the one thing we kind of touched on earlier was that, you know, for me, graduate school was something that I know that I'm going to go back to do. That's a personal goal that I set for myself. But talking to students, like I found lots of students say, okay, if I can get in now, I want to go now because who knows what's going to happen in the next 2 years. But other than that, I would definitely say,
Is social life just as robust on college campuses, even in this sort of crummy economy, as it was when you were on campus?
I think so.
Do you see people wanting to stick closer to home, or are they still pretty footloose?
Pretty footloose, honestly. I haven't came in contact with too many students and say, you know, that I have to stay here. If they have to stay near home, it's usually for personal reasons or family reasons. But no one that I really can remember off top that say, you know, I want to stay home just to stay close to home. I mean, maybe in like the southeastern region, but not necessarily home.
How many applicants to Teach for America actually get selected to be in the program?
There's no cut and dry number. Each year, it just kind of depends on the application pool and which people meet the criteria to the highest level. I can say the year that I applied to Teach for America, they accepted about 20%, but that number fluctuates throughout the year.
So has the quality of candidate changed at all?
I would say not. We've always wanted the best.
In the end, what sort of difference do you see Teach for America making in America's urban schools?
In the end, I would hope that Teach for America doesn't have to exist. I would hope that the achievement gap is closed, and we are desperately fighting to do that by growing each year and going to new regions each year. Ultimately, I see Teach for America closing the achievement gap.
Danique, thanks for your work, and thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you so much. It was good talking to you again.
Danique Nobles is a Teach for America core member who now works for the organization as their recruitment director. We've got a link to more information about Teach for America at our website, smartcityradio.com. This year, Walker Smith looks back on the monumental events that occurred in the year 1980. But our City Views commentator is not being nostalgic. He's looking back to show that prosperity can be a double-edged sword.
In 1980, I was just getting started. I had finished college a few years before and had struggled through an unhappy year in law school and a confused year in a master's program. But I had finally found my passion and was beginning a doctoral program that would shape my future. I was also more or less still a newlywed, having just gotten married a little over a year before. But what strikes me most now is how unaware I was of all the revolutionary things going on around me. That period about 1980, say 1979 to 1982, was significant. To begin with, the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980 began a period of significant change in America's relationship with national government. The prevailing ethos became one of less government, something professed even by Bill Clinton, the only Democratic president during the nearly 30 years from Reagan to Obama. Part of this was fueled by the long bull market run that began in 1982. The Dow Jones Industrial Average went from around 1,000 in 1982 to its peak of over 14,000 in 2007. This was seen as vindication of the pullback in regulation and government intervention in order to let the free market operate. Boomers like me were in our prime during these years. The leading edge of the post-World War II baby boom was 34 in 1980. The trailing edge was 16. Certainly, the demand generated by the largest generational cohort in American history was a crucial factor in the ensuing stock market boom, as well as in all of the other booms and bubbles that took off then, particularly real estate. But the unrestrained booms that began in 1980 or so had some downsides that have been catching up to us for the last several years. For one thing, obesity began to soar right around this time, eventually becoming a public health epidemic that threatens to reverse a century's worth of medical advances through life-shortening complications like diabetes and heart disease. Obesity, though, is just one symptom of a more serious issue that is characteristic of unconstrained booms and bubbles. Research published by the National Academy of Sciences in 2002 has determined that the collective demands of mankind on the resources of the Earth first exceeded the Earth's regenerative capacities around 1980. In other words, for about 30 years, we have been consuming more of the Earth's resources like soil, water, and forest than the Earth is able to replenish. Obviously, this must not continue. We have now come to the end of the era that began in 1980. It seems to me like a lifetime or two ago, even though it really wasn't all that long ago. Yet as I prepare for the final few phases of my life and career, it is instructive to see that I, like everyone, must make a new beginning. What stretched out before me and before us, when we were all at the starting gate, is closed now. We have come to understand that unconstrained booms and bubbles offer no future for a world that must now begin to rebuild and recover. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. There's a lot more Smart City on our website. Join us at smartcityradio.com to sign up for our newsletter, subscribe to our podcast, or contact us and let us know how we're doing. Click on the contact button or send us an email at questions@smartcityradio.com. And watch for our new website coming in what we hope is a couple of weeks. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundation's investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer, engineer, and president of the AV Club. I'm Carol Coletta.